My name is Alex, and I'm an alcoholic.
I'm
my sobriety date is August 16th of 2023, so God willing, I will have 3 years shortly. I like to say I was kind of meant to be here. My parents were very different people, but you hang out with people you wouldn't normally hang out with in Florida rehabs. And that is where my parents met. My parents met in a Florida rehab, and they were very different people who didn't necessarily spend a ton of time together before embarking on a rehab romance. And they both looked at recovery very differently. My father was in the middle of the bed, as they say, for probably the first 10 years of my life. So I was exposed to the rooms very early on. I can remember when there were smoking meetings, which is fun to say because hopefully I don't look old enough to remember those. But I did spend a lot of time in the back of AA meetings as a kid. And my father had sponsees and taught me a lot about the concepts and the principles of the rooms. It did not quite go the same way with my mother, who did struggle with addiction pretty consistently. And I was exposed to a lot of instability because of that. I moved about every 2 years until I was 16, and that was moving cities, moving states about every 2 years, and within those 2 years, there'd be different homes, different apartments, different schools. I got very good at learning how to talk to new people and learning how to quietly observe situations before, you know, interacting so that I could figure out how I could best fit in. And I could shift my personality and the things I would say and the way I acted to fit into a new place, because that was easier than just having to get used to being myself around a bunch of strangers again. And that, along with, you know, financial hardships that come with paying for substances, it was a pretty unstable way to grow up. My parents were very off and on. Rehab turned out to not be a solid foundation for a relationship. And that was a stressful time. Nothing was ever stable. And I very quickly learned that the less I made myself known, the easier things went. The quieter I could be, and the less I needed anything, the better my life was going to go. So I learned a lot of the chameleon tactics that I think are familiar to a lot of people I've met in the rooms. And then when I was 10, 11, 12, I got very sick. And I had my first exposure to prescribed substances, prescribed narcotics. So by the time I was 12, I had a monthly prescription, and even then, right out of the gate, I was not taking things as they told me to take them. But that was okay in my family, because I'd grown up around that. I'd grown up around substances and the idea that, you know, if one is good, two is better. And that just very quickly taught me to rely on something else to help me control my feelings. Because everything already felt so out of control all the time. Nothing was ever stable. I had no say in where I was going to go. I had no sense of safety. And the prescriptions were an easy way to cope with that. It just kept getting worse. I kept getting through prescriptions quicker. My parents' relationship continued to be more and more unstable. You know, the first time they split up, I was kind of devastated, you know, but I was younger, and you know, by the third, fourth time we're going through this, I'm just praying it sticks. And I can just be done with this constant change and the anxiety and the fighting and the toxic relationships. I kept needing more and more prescriptions. And I was also eventually prescribed benzos as well. You know, I respect singleness of purpose, but that's where really everything started with me, was being prescribed controlled substances at a very young age. And it was an easy thing to reach for. By the time I was 16, 17, my parents split up for the final time. It did stick that time. It was just my dad and I, because my dad was always really my safety parent. I always felt more loved by him than I did my mother. And by this point, he has fallen out of the rooms. You know, he had one foot out the door already, but he just had eventually, he'd stopped coming to meetings. He had also decided that, you know, he was an alcoholic, so it was okay if he did other substances, if he dabbled in the dry goods, because he was an alcoholic. That was the thing. And it was a slow walk out of the rooms for him. And while consuming other substances, he would still go to meetings, be in the rooms and things like that. And eventually he just went all the way out and started drinking again as well. So it's just my dad, who's, you know, fallen off the wagon, so to speak, myself and my little brother up in Virginia. And I had always done my best to support my little brother, who is, you know, there's only a 3-year difference, but we didn't necessarily always have a stable parental figure. So I did a lot to take care of him as best as I could at the time, without really having any kind of knowledge or way to know how to do that. He eventually moved back down here to Atlanta, where my grandparents have always lived, with my mother and my grandmother. And that was the final thing that gave me some sort of control of myself, something that kept me a little bit from completely delving into addiction. By this point, you know, I've got the prescriptions, I've begun drinking, I've looked into other substances, which, again, was okay in my life. I mean, most of my exposures to any substance was with my father. So it was not like I had any kind of consequences for doing these things. And then, you know, my little brother's kind of that last shred of something I have as a reason not to. So I fully dove into it, nothing holding me back anymore. And I'm just absolutely miserable inside. I've never had any kind of stability. And because I had learned, or taught myself, really, that the less I existed, the better. And I had done so much crisis management, you know, being emotional support to my parents, to my father, being a best friend and being a wife at times, being the runner of the household. All of my self-worth was tied to being needed. And my little brother, in my mind, didn't need me anymore. And that was really, really, really difficult for me. I felt very abandoned, even though this is a teenager living in a house with two people who are actively unstable and using substances, and he was just trying to do what he had to do for himself. But I felt very abandoned. I had nothing to hold me back, and I had lost this last shred of validation for existing. So I immediately latched on to a man that would need me to take care of him. Because what else was I going to do? And I was introduced to even more substances and just diving deeper into this codependent spiral because I didn't know how to exist and make decisions for myself. And I had never really been taught a work ethic or a sense of commitment or responsibility. You know, I was raised by two addicts, and if I didn't want to do something, I didn't have to, is the only example I'd ever had. And I just spent about 3 years in active daily use, and it was a very dark place. There were times I wouldn't know where I was going to sleep that night. The anxiety of never having enough, of toying with the idea of maybe doing something different. Because remember, I knew what AA was. I had seen it work for my dad. I had seen it work for other people. But I am not my mother. And I am not my father. And I don't need help like they do. I was not an alcoholic. And it kept me going for a long time, this fear of having to admit that I was an alcoholic. Because in my mind, that was the same as, that meant I was the same as the people I used to justify doing whatever I wanted, really. I didn't want to be the same as them. And as long as I could blame all of my problems on them, then I could justify staying drunk. And I did finally reach a point where I didn't want to keep living the way I was living, but I still wasn't ready to jump over that hurdle. So I was just going to come back to it. I was just going to fly to Atlanta and be sober and just not drink, not do anything else. And that did not work. I came back here, and I was really determined to just stop and do something different, and I genuinely wanted to, but abusing alcohol and anything else was the only tool I had to deal with this giant void inside of me. And the only way I could numb anything out enough to get through the day. But I still really, really didn't want to actually do anything. So if I just got prescriptions again, that would be okay. Because it's from a doctor, and I'm going to take them how they tell me I should take them. And I did not do that. And then, you know, my prescription bottles are empty. If I just smoke a little something, it's okay. It's natural. It's going to be fine. That's not so bad. And then that just wasn't cutting it. So I started doing other things that I would only do on the weekends. And that also did not last long either. And I just kept getting deeper into other substances. And I reached a point where, you know, as long as it's not that one bad thing, then I'm okay. Because that's really where I have to draw the line. That one really makes me an alcoholic. And then my mother overdosed and died. And that was a really, really dark time. My mother hadn't necessarily ever tried to stay sober. She never really had enough clarity that she had a problem to ever really consider getting help for a problem. And that was really a horrible time. I found her and everything. I had to tell my grandmother. I had to hear the way my little brother just yelled when the police officer told me, you know, that sound is going to stay with me forever. And logically, you would think that maybe I'd kind of cut back on doing some things. And I did the opposite, because I had more of a reason than ever now. I had more of an excuse to just do whatever I wanted. And I did. And it was horrible. And then I ended up doing that one particular thing that I wasn't going to do. And I overdosed in the same house 10 feet away from where my mother died. You know, that's something I did to my family. And that kept me off that one particular substance, at least, for a little while. And every day, I just wanted to do that one thing. And every day I wanted to do it a little bit more, and a little bit more. And it was finally able to kind of click in my head that I will do this again if I don't get help. Because I wanted to. And that was absolutely terrifying to recognize that lack of control. But again, I had that exposure to recovery. I had that exposure to AA, and I knew it could work. So I was willing to finally go to rehab. I did decide I was willing to go to rehab, but I didn't have insurance. I didn't have any kind of savings at this point. I've just been wandering my way through life as a haunted ghost for 6 or 7 years. So I went to a state-funded rehab in Midtown. I went to St. Jude's, and it was a miserable experience. I went into rehab just thinking I could get some rest, figure out how to live life without hard drugs on a day-to-day basis, go home, be able to drink a little bit sometimes. I just needed kind of a break and a little bit of help not doing hard drugs every day. And I was horrible in rehab. I was not in a place where I was well enough to be honest with myself or other people. And that, you know, combined with an environment where most of the staff and the people there to help me have no experience with alcoholism and addiction, and they don't have any way to personally relate. You know, I had more reason than I needed to fight as much as I could. And I had a very, very difficult time at St. Jude's. I did not graduate. I spent about 5.5 months there. And this was an inpatient intense program. So I really was stuck for about 5.5 months. And I reached a point where I was just absolutely miserable, and I could not keep going. So I ended up at Peachford while still sober. And then the case manager at Peachford handed me 2 phone numbers. The first was for a men's inpatient rehab. So I didn't go to that one. But I was also given a phone number for a sober living, and I called. And they didn't have a bed the first time I called, but they told me to keep calling. And the second time I called, they had room for me. So I set that up. And that was the first decision I had ever made completely on my own, completely by myself. I was still under the impression that I could just go back to my grandmother's, because that was the agreement that got me to go into rehab. Right, I would just go to rehab, I'd get myself together, I'd come home, everything would be fine. And here I am, and my grandmother's saying, oh, even if you graduate, you can't come back here. Which was absolutely devastating at that time. But I was able to make a decision for myself. And that was the first decision I had ever made completely by myself, for myself. And I asked 0 questions I had no idea it was a women's campus. I had no idea I'd have to work. I didn't know I'd be in a, I didn't know anything. But I had nowhere to go, and they were willing to take me. So I said, please. And I came, and I had about, you know, 5.5 months sober. And I just knew all these things about AA and recovery. And I just knew all these wonderful things that meant I would be a great addition to the meetings at NABA, and they were lucky to have me. And I was very much a know-it-all because I had that exposure to the rooms, and I could quote the book, and I knew the sayings, and I remembered all the little phrases my dad would say to his sponsees and all the things he'd complain about the rooms, and I could also read, right? I can read. So I know all these things, and I have all this familiarity, so I could tell you which parts of AA would help me and which ones I didn't really need to do. And I didn't do all of the things that AA suggested I do. I didn't pray. I was not interested in the concept of a higher power. In my mind, had never had that, right? There was never a higher power in my life to help me, and I don't need it now. I was so used to relying on myself my whole life. And obviously, I did a fantastic job, and I'm very reliable, but I would still be okay just relying on myself. I didn't have a level of genuine honesty because I did not want anyone to know about all the gross, dark stuff inside. I was still very much tied to that idea of conditional love and self-worth that I had grown up with, where the less I need, the better things are, and the more people love me. So I had a sponsor, and I would call her every couple of days to tell her how great everything was and how much I loved being sober. At home in a sober living apartment, losing my mind because this shower schedule really just makes sense. And everyone's lives would go so much better because we all have different work schedules. And this would just, it'd just be great if you guys would do this. And I'm losing my mind, and I'm so anxious all the time. And I'm so worried about everything, and I can't breathe, and I can't trust anybody enough to be honest with them. And it took about 9 months of that, 9 months of sobriety, of 4 or 5 meetings a week, of having, being in a sober living, having friends in recovery, and I am just absolutely rock bottom miserable. And I got desperate enough to just consider that maybe people know something I don't, and maybe I should just try all the different things I didn't want to do. And that was really scary. My alcoholism, my disease fits squarely in my ego, and I would see benefits of it. You know, like I would just try praying, and things would get kind of better, and then my alcoholism would tell me how stupid I was for fighting all those things, and this can't actually be true, because my ego doesn't want to let me think that I can ever be wrong about anything, because it still tells me it's never okay to be wrong. So I would do these things I hadn't considered doing, and I'd get benefits from them, and I would still not want to keep doing them because I would just jump through all these hoops in my brain because everything just sits in my ego. But I was willing to get honest, so I was willing to keep trying those things and be open with other people and genuine and call people while they were at work and be freaking out over absolutely nothing. And because I did that, I learned that people answer the phone. and they'll still keep answering the phone. Without that honesty and that vulnerability, I never would have learned that people could genuinely love me. No matter if I made mistakes or if I was a horrible person or if I had been selfish, that people will love me enough to call me out on that and then answer the phone the next time I called, which I've never had. And I had never had a sense of community. I'd never stayed in one place long enough. And that is what I found in the rooms. Sorry. And that was a really, really big thing for me to trust and believe. That made it easier to keep going through the steps. I spent a long time before recovery on step one, just being willing to admit that I was an alcoholic and I was the same as everybody else, that I wasn't actually special or different enough to fight my way through alcoholism. And I spent a good little while on two and three because I just was so stubborn about not needing a higher power, that I could just figure things out, and I wasn't open-minded. And I had to really be shown that it was my concept, and I had to let go of a lot of these preconceived notions and stop just fighting everything. You know, I'd always felt like I never had a right way to pray. You know, like nothing ever felt like I was doing it right, and it just didn't. Felt weird, and I didn't like it, and it turns out if I wanted to find the way of praying that works for me, I had to actually try praying in various ways. Who would have thought? But I was desperate enough to try that, and I did, and I started to become open to this idea of relying on something, because I had been thoroughly convinced that I could not rely on myself. And the concept became a bit more concrete and a bit more tangible the more effort I put into looking for it. Step four was really, really big for me. You know, logically, I had a concept that my actions affect other people and that my actions have consequences. But the reality and the gravity of that did not hit until I did a fourth step. I truly did not understand the way my actions had consequences until I did that, because it allowed me to realize that I had spent my whole life hanging on to all these horrible things that people had done and being unwilling to let it go, and all these ways that people had hurt me. I had never truly taken a look at the things I had done in my life and understand that regardless of whatever my intentions were, I did make these actions and I did make these choices. But I want the world around me to look at my intentions and forgive my actions, and I was not willing to do that for other people. And that change in my perspective changed the whole way I looked at the world. The fourth and fifth step changed the entire way I look at the world around me and the people in it. And six and seven is always an ongoing process. I'm going through the steps again with the sponsor I have now. And, you know, she was telling me, you'll have less the second time around that you do the steps. It'll be great. And I had more this time around because she has a different checklist. She has a much longer checklist than my first sponsor did. So I had a bunch more the second time around. But doing it again, I was able to look at things I hadn't looked at before because she had a different list. And that's been a very, very good experience recently. Eight and nine were scary, but I also really come back to always hearing that the steps were in order for a reason, right? Because by the time I get to the fourth step, I have this connection, this concept of a higher power that I can rely on to help me through 4 and 5. And by the time I get to 8 and 9, I've done a 4 and 5 to truly understand what it is I'm supposed to be doing, and I have these things. So it was scary, but it was also really good. And I had, you know, lucky experiences. I had receptive people. It was good. 10 and 11 are also always works in progress. I look for the character defects more often. I pay attention to when I take things back from my higher power, because I still do. But I give it back a lot quicker now. You know, I take it back less often, and I give it back a lot quicker now. But I have to constantly be monitoring for those things, and I have to remember that I have to have this connection to a higher power in order to have the ability to rely on it. Or else it's just some thing in the corner that I'll throw something at every now and then. You know, if I don't maintain that relationship, I'm not going to have the ability to faithfully rely on something, and the relief and the trust that comes with that. 12 has been really interesting. That's been really, really, really beautiful. I see something new every time I start with a sponsee. Every time I go through anything in the book or say anything, I see something new and I learn something new. And I'm reminded that I have to do these things I ask these people to do. Like, that's really annoying. And it's another good way to keep myself accountable. I've had some really beautiful relationships out of it. And I hope to get someone all the way through all the steps one day. That would be really nice. It's easier to look at the way my life has changed. I have a wonderful job, like an actual adult job in an office. And I supervise people, which is crazy. And it's the rooms that gave me, you know, looking back, there were so many times I was so frustrated at the job I was working at before, and I was miserable, and I had so many complaints. And looking back now, that job allowed me to schedule that let me develop the relationship I have with the person in the rooms who got me the job I have now. And I think that's one of the biggest examples of not just how my life has changed, but how I have changed. That today I can look back on things and see things like that and be grateful for them and admit that I was not always the best employee at my last job. I was not always the best sober person. And I'm able to look at things differently. I have a whole different perspective on life. And I love that I have a washer and dryer today. Like, that is amazing. But it's that I'm able to look at it with the gratitude, that I'm able to look at something and be grateful for it and realize that I have to do some things I don't want to do sometimes to make sure I keep a washer and dryer accessible. You know? Like, I have to stay in the rooms and be a good employee and do all these things. And I just look at everything so differently now because of the steps. I have a community. I know what unconditional love is. I know how to be a little bit more open to criticism. And that's what it is. I can hear things now and not feel like the world is falling apart. But that's a far cry from where I was before. I couldn't breathe without something every 2 hours. I could not sit in my skin. I could not make any kind of decision. I didn't know how to have relationships with other people. I didn't know how to be honest. I didn't know how to let things go. I didn't know what acceptance was. And it's the steps. and my network that have taught me all of those things. And it's not just that I have a different life now and that I know where I'm going to sleep tonight. I'm a different person now, and I see the world differently, and I interact with the world differently. I'm just so beyond grateful. I really, in the beginning, wasn't sure it would work for me because it wasn't working for me. But I just wasn't doing all the things it asked me to. And the more I felt like it wasn't working, the more it wasn't working. You know, like I just had to accept that I am the same as everybody else in recovery, and I have to do all of those things too. And once I was able to get there and I started doing the things people who were happy said I should do, I got a little bit happier, and my hope in the program has turned into faith in the program because I have that experience now. And I think that's where I'm going to stop. I think that's where I'm going to
stop. Great job, Alex.
First I slip, and then I clip to a hope-filled dream. Rescue me, and finally, waking there I see. I look into love's window for a soul that's been falling in. Takes me where the promise. All in. Sometimes quickly, sometimes slow, we get just what we need. On a broad highway, God walks by, we walk eternally. Thank you.